The explosion had not breached the wall, so that the work it had wrought on the far side was left for Lee to imagine as he felt the force wash over him, felt his heart quail, and felt himself briefly thinking, oh, good.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Novelist Susan Choi says she often draws straight from the headlines, and her approach seems to work. Her 2004 novel, American Woman, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. It's based on the story of Patty Hearst. This week, Choi reads from her new psychological thriller. It's called A Person of Interest. It's about a reclusive math professor responding to the murder of a popular colleague. The novel was inspired, to an extent, by the Unabomber and Wen-Ho Lee, the Los Alamos scientist wrongly targeted by the U.S. government for spying. Choi says she's interested in stories that seem to have another story hidden inside them. She says A Person of Interest is about suspicion and alienation, and how Lee, the protagonist, fails to perform his innocence properly. This reading of A Person of Interest took place in February 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Hi, thanks everyone for coming. I think that what I'll do is read two short sections, and the first is going to just be the first few pages of the book, because I was sitting there trying to figure out how to explain the other passage that I wanted to read, and I thought, well, why not just read the first few pages, and then no explanation is required. So I'm going to read just the first few pages, and then a passage from a little deeper in. It was only after Hendley was bombed that Lee was forced to admit to himself just how much he disliked him. A raw, never-mind vein of thought, in an instant laid bare by the force of explosion. Of course, it was typical in his profession for diminishing elders to harbor ill will toward their junior colleagues. But Lee, who had been tenured in his department for more than 20 years, felt that he was exempt from the obsolescence that infected most other professors his age. He was still capable of the harsh princeliness he'd possessed in his youth, although now he was half through his 60s and his hair was all white. That old aristocratic hauteur would return suddenly, and his loose, dowdy trousers, always belted too high, would seem to sit on a younger man's waist. The liver spots that had come to his face would be bleached by the glare pouring forth from his eyes. His wasn't the kind of temperament spouse or child or friend had ever wanted to cleave to, but for his students it had the power to impress. Like most of their peers, they found the notion of mentorship fusty. Unlike Lee in his own student days, they shunned the emeritus aura. They mostly wanted teachers who acted like pals. This was why they'd loved Hendley. But they didn't scorn Lee quite as much, he felt sure, as they did the other professors his age, the old men with their elbow-patched tweeds and their stay-at-home wives who made cookies and tea for the very few students who still bothered to seek professorial counsel. Then again, there were times Lee was forced to believe the exact opposite, that his students had neither respect nor affection for him. He sat idle during his twice-weekly office hours, as did most of his aged colleagues. A crisp yellow legal pad squared before him on his clean desk, a Mont Blanc fountain pen with black ink in his hand. He'd always worked in black ink, an affectation he'd suffered since youth. A sign of arrogance, his first wife might have said. Of humility, he might have parried. Ink kept one's errors on record. But whatever his Mont Blanc denoted, there were fewer and fewer to give their opinions. His office hours were an empty detention, unvisited, and unproductive for him, no matter how he pretended. Each afternoon, he would carefully stand the door open 12 inches, or the width someone needed to duck in casually and say hi, not wide open as if in eager anticipation, and not merely slightly ajar, as if he begrudged this time for his students. He didn't. He sat poised on the brink of the legal pad, seemingly lost in his putative thoughts, the Mont Blanc in his fingers. Each set of footsteps he heard in the hallway launched him on a theatrical scratching of pen upon notepad. He would feel his face stiffen with self-consciousness and will his eyes not to dart toward the door. The footsteps were almost never for him. The rare occasions they were, he was always the same, as if reluctantly drawn from the pool of deep thought. Ah, he would say, tempering his forbidding absorption with a lift of his eyebrows. But most often, as he twitched with unsure expectation, the footsteps past his office, his door too little open for him to see who it was, and instead stopped at Hendley's office next door. There would already be a lively murmur of whispers, students sprawled on the floor of the hallway with their backpacks awaiting their turns, and through the wall, the not quite comprehensible but very audible rumble of Hendley himself holding forth, and a student's unselfconscious laughter, punctuated by the robotic bleeps and the primitive honks Hendley's two huge computers gave off. Lee's dislike of Hendley was all the more painful to him for his having until now been ignorant of it. Had he known, he might have forgiven himself his eager awkwardness in the face of Hendley's camaraderie, the "oh yeses" he would hear himself helplessly blurting whenever Hendley found him at their faculty coffee events. As Lee carefully blew on his thin paper cup, Hendley would clap him on the shoulder so the hot coffee jumped, as if Lee were the person he'd most hoped to see. Hendley would launch into a long anecdote, as if Lee were the person he'd most wanted to hear it, as if theirs were the sort of friendship in which all was assumed, which required no work. And in response, Lee would hear himself saying, "oh yes," would feel his head bobbing in dumb agreement, as if the past 40 years hadn't happened and he was fresh off the boat with 10 phrases of English etched painstakingly in his mind. His dislike of Hendley might have prepared him somewhat, if not for what happened, then at least for the dislike itself, the cold shock of his first addled thought when he'd felt the vast fist of the detonation like a bubble of force that had popped in his face. He'd felt his heart lurch, begin to flop in disorder and fear. He'd seen with his own eyes his wall of university-issue bookcases, the cheap metal kind with adjustable shelves, seem to ride the wall separating his office from Hendley's as if they were liquid, a wave. He had waited an endless instant, the eon between beats of his heart, for those bookcases so laden with waxy math texts to crash down in one motion and kill him. But somehow they had not. The explosion. He'd known right away it was a bomb. Unlike almost all of his colleagues, he knew the feel of bombs intimately. Had somehow not breached the wall through which, day after day, he heard Hendley's robust voice and his bleeping computer and the strange goose-like yodel of Hendley's dial-up modem when it reached its objective. The explosion had not breached the wall, so that the work it had wrought on the far side was left for Lee to imagine as he felt the force wash over him, felt his heart quail, and felt himself briefly thinking, "oh, good." Leek's colleague Hendley actually does die as a result of this letter bomb that he receives in the mail, and Lee, although he's horrified by his initial, I guess it's like extreme Schadenfreude because he's happy, he's initially horrified by his reaction, but he pulls himself together and actually speaks very eloquently to the press when they interview him about his feelings about the murder. And it's only when he receives a letter from someone out of his past who has seen him on television talking about the bombing that Lee's life starts to unravel and that his behavior starts to become increasingly erratic, and he gradually, unbeknownst to himself, becomes an object of suspicion, not just to his colleagues and his neighbors, but to the FBI investigators who are working on the murder. I'm going to read a very different and also brief section now from a little bit later in the book. Lee has been interviewed a few times by an FBI agent, and he's not at all aware of the fact that he is the person the FBI agent is interested in. He thinks that he's being helpful. And so after his latest interview with the agent, he decides to mow his lawn. And I should say that Lee actually also has two divorces under his belt. His first wife is dead, and his only child is estranged from him. There are a lot of issues and problems in his life. So he'll be reflecting on those people. Eileen is his dead wife, and Esther is his estranged grown daughter. That afternoon, Lee changed into old slacks and a t-shirt and wrestled his ancient push mower out into the sun. He hated lawn mowing. It offered none of the pleasures of plant tending and 10 times the toil. But he also hated to pay for lawn mowing, and the infrequency with which he did it had long ago set his lawn on the path of dereliction, so that his reluctance to mow was complicated by guilt, which only made him stall further. Even after resolving to mow, he found much to derail him. There was, for a start, the disgraceful condition of his mower, with its deathbed repertoire of labored drones, its concealed set of loose nut maracas, its juddering blade, and its dried algal scum of the dead sod of ages gone by. Add the clumsy lashing motion required to yank start the engine and the geriatric gasping unleashed, and once the mowing began, the law of contrasts by which a shave for the lawn cast in glaring relief the shagginess of his flowers and shrubs. At least there were few witnesses. The generic children of his nearby neighbors must all still be in school. No scuffed plastic big wheels or tasseled tricycles or banana seat training wheeled bikes were being pedaled in driveways. The elaborate cedar play fortress of his right-hand neighbor was abandoned, its turrets and drawbridges noiselessly soaking up sun. At the moment, no paired female walkers were huffing past with pert ponytailed hair and clenched fists. Lee was sometimes shown the raised hand or quick smile of the walker whose habit it was to greet all human beings this way. He didn't know anyone's name, nor did he give much thought to these reflexive acknowledgments. They were just part of the life of a smallish American town. As he finished the very thin strip to the left of his driveway, which he always did first for the quick, easy sense of accomplishment, the lone howl of his mower was joined by another commotion. His across-the-street neighbor's small house, the same model as his, just a little too much for an old man entirely alone, and just barely enough for a couple with a toddler and baby, briefly quaked, then erupted, some restraint overcome. The resident toddler rushed out the front door, shrieking and naked except for a diaper, and disappeared around the side of the house with the mother and a hip-riding baby in awkward pursuit. Lee didn't know the name of this toddler, or even its sex. But now that he thought about it, plodding with his slight weight pressed forward against the mower, he recalled that for the past several weeks, there was scarcely a day this scene wasn't enacted. The child must have just learned to walk, or to open the front door, or both. What would that be? 14 months? That was the age Esther had been when she'd worn her first shoes. The three of them, Lee, Eileen, and Esther, had lived on Sawyer Street then, in a part of town now entirely different, for one thing entirely black. Lee hadn't been there in years, not even to trawl the now broken streets for his best memories. But Sawyer Street existed without flaw in his mind. Their very first house, their beachhead as a new family. He and Eileen had been married 4 years. He'd had his doctorate for one. Esther had been going on 1.5. They'd had a little metal stroller for Esther that, compared with the strollers of today, was as crude as a Ford Model T. But Lee had approved of its ungainly weight, perhaps because he was pushing a rolling thing now, leaned at such a sharp angle for progress that he might appear to be walking into a stiff wind. This recollection of pushing Esther in her stroller overtook him completely. It fell onto him like a cloak, and now the breeze on his bare arms was balmy and sweet, and the sun had dropped off the zenith and blunted its rays. It was early morning, and his brown hands were young and wrapped confidently around the twin rubber handles, and he saw his smooth knees and his tan, slender shins and the toes of his leather sandals, always almost stubbed on the stroller's big wheels. With Esther, he'd also leaned forward, pushed the thing with his body aslant to avoid this annoyance. A posture he dimly recognized was in some way female. All the strollers were misdesigned in this way, though at the time no one called it a flaw. It was just how strollers were, the handles rising straight from the rear wheels so that you had to lean forward to not stub your toes. And this was the profile of all the neighborhood's women, and it was also Lee's profile. And he didn't mind this self-feminization. In fact, he secretly liked it. Esther, sitting very erect in her low riding seat, often banging the palm of one hand on the metal restraint bar as if urging a horse to speed up. This gesture was very peremptory. It allowed of no doubt that the order would be promptly obeyed. And Lee always had his gaze trained on the crown of her head, on her very dark yet also wonderfully soft, wispy hair, which curled outward in all directions in contradictory wavelets. Eileen's hair was wavy that way, but entirely different in color, a very pale brown, while Lee's hair was typically Asian, the color of Esther's, but straight as a broom, so that Esther's was a miracle blending of Lee and Eileen. "It's not so astounding," Eileen once remarked. "All babies have very soft hair. Yours was probably like that." In other words, Eileen was saying, Esther's hair was like Lee's, and Eileen had no part in it. Why had she said this? And with a slight emphasis on all babies, which carried a meaning Lee chose to ignore. Lee pushed harder, surged more powerfully through his forearms, and as if in response to the increase in speed, Esther raised an arm over her head. "Yah, yah, yah," Esther called. The asphalt was smooth, the street recent, all the aluminum-clad little houses proudly tended, still new. In this scene, Lee is, as in every scene of his life prior and subsequent, a novelty. But the novelty of his novelty here is how well people like him. They might see him as an anomaly, a suburban Yul Brynner with his vague provenance and his careful English, but they also see a devoted father, and they embrace him. Esther's perfect happiness at this age is confirmed on all sides. She sleeps soundly, eats like a wolf, and now walks on small, powerful legs. She isn't yet old enough to perceive the cross-currents of tension, even of misery, that are already warping the walls of the Sawyer Street house. And maybe Lee isn't old enough either, though he's older than all of his neighbors by a decade or more, the father of a toddler, his first child, and he's already 40. Yet he feels fantastically young. Or is it that, for the first time in life, he feels optimistic? He yelped at a terrible noise, something violently hacked, as the handle leaped out of his hands. There was a double instant, Esther's small, compact weight torn from him. Lee was practically fainting now on top of the lawnmower, the blade fearsomely gnashing, but he'd only run over a branch. Thank you. The brave first brave, questioner.
Yeah. I just wanted to know how you separated out the newsworthiness source of this story, or one of the sources of this story, from your imagination, how you kept the two separate or how you intertwined them.
I don't think I succeeded in keeping them separate. The question, it's an interesting question. I guess the newsworthy sources that you're talking about are, there's a little of the Unabomber mixed in here. There's a little Wen Ho Lee mixed in here. There's some Stephen Hatfill, and I guess a little Richard Jewell thrown in too, because what happens to Professor Lee essentially is that he's declared a person of interest by the FBI, which, as you probably know by now, doesn't mean that he's a suspect, because there's actually no, the FBI doesn't really have a case, but it means that they think there's something fishy about him. So person of interest is a meaningless term legally, but it's a very powerful term socially. And that's what happens to Professor Lee, although he's actually innocent of the murder of his colleague. And initially with this book, I guess I'd been interested in the Unabomber part of things, because my initial premise was, what if this aging, mediocre, sort of messed up math professor lived through the murder of his colleague by a letter bomb, and then discovered that he knew the killer, because it turns out that Lee actually has a past connection with the person who sent the bomb. But the point at which I realized that my Professor Lee was going to become a suspect himself, or actually just suspicious, that was when these other real-life cases that I had followed with great interest when they were unfolding, Wen Ho Lee and Richard Jewell and Stephen Hatfill, et cetera, started sort of imposing themselves on my story.
You talked about Wen Ho Lee and the Unabomber, and I was wondering if... I'm going to mangle the facts, because this is something that I remember from...
That's okay. I do that too.
About 15, maybe 20 years ago, there was a case of involving a Korean-American man, a immigrant first-generation Korean-American man whose family died in a house fire, and it was determined that the cause of the fire was arson. And I don't remember what happened to the case, but from my recollection, he became the chief suspect in the arson, because when he approached the fire, his reaction was absolutely devoid of any emotion at all. And the police thought that was very strange when it's, if you know something about the way Korean men act in Korean culture, it's probably not so strange. And I was wondering if that, if you knew anything, if you had heard about that case at all, if that was a source of inspiration at all, because just reading the book jacket, that's the first thing that I had thought of.
That's incredible. Where did that happen, actually?
It was either Pennsylvania or New Jersey.
You know, I actually don't know that case. Okay. That's amazing. If you can think of any other details, I'd love to hear them later. No. So the answer is no, I wasn't thinking of that particular case, not having known of it. But that is, you bring up an aspect of the story that I was very interested in, which is this idea that I started having that that innocence, as we understand it in our culture, is very theatrical, actually, because with my character, he misresponds, if that's even a word. He fails to respond in the way in which everyone thinks he should respond to the catastrophe of his colleague's murder. His initial very private response, which he doesn't share with anyone, is relief or happiness, because he realizes that he has harbored this terrible load of envy against this man. So initially he thinks, oh, good, that takes care of him. He doesn't share this with anyone, but what he does do is he fails to sort of perform grief in the proper manner, and this draws attention to him initially. He skips the campus-wide memorial service. There's a huge memorial, and there's a tremendous amount of sort of public grief that happens, and you know, students weeping and ribbons being worn and stuff. And he finds it all very distasteful, and he ends up blowing off the memorial. And this is strike two against him, because then people sort of can't believe he did that, and they start thinking like, well, why exactly didn't he come to the memorial? And this, instead of just being a sort of an unfortunate aspect of his personality, it actually starts to be part of this case that's being built against him. And later, when he realizes that he is sort of officially suspected, even though he hasn't been named a suspect, he kind of can't perform his innocence properly, and he just makes it worse. He can't sort of, like, you know, at some point somebody says to him, you know what you need to do? You need to just go out, go to the grocery store, smile at your neighbors, be friendly, act like a normal person. But he hides in his house in terror because he's suddenly being scrutinized. In other words, he reacts the way I would, and the way I think a lot of us would if suddenly we were accused of something we hadn't done. He doesn't get out there and cheerfully hold a press conference talking about how he's just a normal guy. And so I did think a lot about the fact that in our culture we expect almost saintly behavior from people, even if they're innocent of crimes. If they're not also saintly, we find there to be something wrong with them. Anyway, thanks for your question.
I have a question following up on that. Are you at all familiar? I've just become fascinated with the books about Dexter. Anyone else? It's just become a TV show, but it's also a series of books. And it's all about how he has learned how to perform so that he isn't suspected. I don't know if you know the premise, but it's interesting because it's sort of
Dexter's
reverse.
The lovable serial killer.
Yeah, and the whole point is he's been taught how to have the proper reactions so he isn't suspected. So it's interesting because it's kind of the reverse of your situation.
Right. Well, the first thing that I should say is that I'm on a private boycott against the show Dexter because my adorable 3.5-year-old son is named Dexter. And so this show is a little bit of a problem for me. And you know, now he, like, sees the posters and he can read his name and he'll be like, oh, Mommy! And, you know, when am I going to have to explain to him that it's a show about, like, a serial killer? That's what I hear. I hear he's such a nice serial killer. No, but it's interesting what you say, because the flip side of it is that people who are guilty of heinous crimes, if they can perform, that often ameliorates our reaction. I mean, was it Ted Bundy who was the enormously charming killer? A certain former football player whose name I won't name, who perhaps is guilty, perhaps is not, who knows? But, you know, I think something about his charisma and celebrity definitely had to do with the way in which his case was viewed by the public. So, yeah, it's a really good point. The flip side is that if you're charming enough, you can get away with anything. One of the basic things about Professor Lee is that he's a difficult person. He's one of these people. I love him dearly as a character, but he doesn't know his neighbors. He doesn't get along that well with his colleagues. He has 2 divorces under his belt, lives alone. His grown-up daughter doesn't speak to him. He hasn't expended a lot of energy charming the world, and this ends up having terrible consequences for him, when it really shouldn't. But you know, all of these flaws, they're just character flaws, end up in some way like adding fuel to the fire when investigators decide that maybe his behavior is suspicious. Another thing that happens is that, you know, his guilt is very complicated in the book because he does feel guilt about his reaction to the murder. And also, he's harboring a lot of guilt about crimes that he's committed that are not, you know, crimes legally, but they're sort of emotional crimes against the people in his life that were closest to him. So he harbors a lot of guilt, and he sort of just wears it on his sleeve, and it's misinterpreted to disastrous effect. Yeah.
I read American Woman, and I'm wondering about historical fiction now, and when you're reading the paper, are you constantly looking for characters? Are you thinking about how we fictionalize these characters in some way, and why historical fiction? So if you could look at that a little bit, that would be interesting.
It's a good question. I mean, thanks. American Woman, which is my second book, is loosely based on the Patty Hearst kidnapping, and I never set out to write historical fiction, and it's still funny for me to think of myself as someone who writes historical fiction because it seems like a really fusty, musty term in a way, and yet it clearly applies. I don't know. I tend to find I'm really fascinated by journalism, I guess, and I do read the paper not with an eye to book number 4, but I do read the paper pretty voraciously, and I tend to become fascinated by stories that seem to have another story hidden in them that's not being told in the media, because it's not the kind of story that the media would tell us about. I mean, The American Woman was a book that I became obsessed with writing after I discovered, I was interested in the Patty Hearst kidnapping just because it was this sort of lurid and sensational episode that had unfolded when I was a child. And so I'd sort of been interested to know what exactly that had been all about. And when I started reading about it, I stumbled upon this Asian American woman who had been very, very peripherally involved, so peripherally involved that she's almost never mentioned in any of the press reports of the Patty Hearst case. But it turned out that she had been sort of living in hiding with Patricia Hearst for many, many, many months before they were both arrested. And that untold story of that friendship fascinated me, and that was what triggered that book. And so I think that I'm always looking at the lurid stories that occupy the front pages for the part of that story that's not really being told, if that makes sense. Like the Wen Ho Lee case also interested me because while I followed the Times coverage and was fascinated by the Times coverage, what I kept wondering was what his home life was like. I kept sort of thinking, like, what does Wen Ho Lee do when he wakes up in the morning? Like, is he still making coffee? Like, does he raise the blinds? Are the drapes shut? Like, does he go out and get the paper? Or does he get somebody to, like, bring it up to the door for him? I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, these little details. And, in fact, when I later read his memoir, I was fascinated by all of the details about his everyday life that he disclosed. Like, for example, that he did continue to try to live life as he had lived it before, almost defiantly, in a way that kind of performed his innocence, in the way that Professor Lee can't manage to do. Wen Ho Lee he loved to fish, so he would just go fishing, and he would be tailed by 15 cars with 15 FBI agents in the cars, and he would get in his car with his fishing tackle, and he would drive to the river, and he would lead this caravan, and they would all follow, and they'd all park, and he'd cast, and they'd all just get out of their cars and watch him the whole time that he fished. And I thought that was amazing. It's like so courageous of him that he was just like, I'm going to do what I do, and if you guys want to watch me on the taxpayer's dime, okay. So that's the kind of detail that I'm always fixating on in the context of a real life story, and that usually ends up sort of triggering my fiction. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.